That was Dale Okazaki and Maria Hernandez on the 17th. Right. Dale Okazaki and her were roommates in a condo. Mm-hmm. Dale was already home. Yep. And Maria Hernandez came in. He made a deliberate noise, slapped the top of a vehicle. He was on a carpet runner. Slapped the top of the vehicle so she could turn around and see him when he came point shoulder. He could have popped her in the head. He didn't. He wanted her to see him.
He wanted that fear.
Exactly. So he fired. And as soon as he fired, everything went black because she had just hit the garage door closer. And it would hit the button. Timing took 8 seconds from the time he hit the button to the time it closed. And it was pitch black. And he tells me later on, he says, shit, I thought I was dead. Because the ringing of the gun, he saw the sparks go out. She went down to the ground. And then it turned black. And he says, shit, I thought I was dead.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Welcome back, everyone, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade. Now, today we have with us a very special guest, Gil Carrillo. Now, if you happen to watch the Night Stalker series on Netflix, a very well done piece on Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. Now, myself and Ignacio Esteban covered the Night Stalker about a month or so back in our Behind the Serial Killer shorts that we do. Today, we actually got Gil to come on. Gil was the guy, if you remember that documentary, that was leading the charge against Richard. He was the top detective on the case. They hunted him all throughout his tenure of him terrorizing, you know, the Los Angeles area. And he was gracious enough to come on and kind of share that experience with us here today. I think you guys will really like this. It's from start to finish, Gil Carrillo hunting Richard Ramirez here on Crime and Entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. I have here today a very special guest. Now, if anyone has seen the Netflix documentary on Richard Ramirez, this man should be, you know, no stranger to you. It's one of the key guys that helped bring him down. Please welcome to the show, Gil Carrillo. Gil, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing just fine. Fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Now, you're in L.A. right now, correct?
I'm in L.A. right now.
I'm 40 years old. I just made my first trip to LA a few weeks ago. I had a few podcast shows to be on out there, and it is quite a city.
And that's minimally stated.
Yeah, that's minimally stated. I mean, I was a little disappointed, at least in the area where I was at, like nightlife, because I was on, I guess that's like the Sunset Strip where Whiskey a Go Go and the Viper sure. Room and all that stuff yeah. was. So I'm growing up like hearing all these stories about these places and just how crazy it was. And like they were shutting down at 12 o'clock.
Yeah, that was the old Whiskey and Go-Go, the old everything. And they're trying to keep crime down. It's up West Hollywood way. They're trying to keep it down. Ah. They're trying to take things under control.
Wow. I was just like, we left a little restaurant, went in Whiskey and Go-Go. The band wrapped it up. And they were like, all right, we're shutting the doors. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I looked at my watch. I'm like, what the hell? So we walk down, and I see the Viper Room. I'm like, oh, I've heard a lot about this club. Let's go in here. She's like, we're almost about to do last call. If you want to buy one drink, and then we're closing it down. I'm like, this is not what I pictured. but now, were you born and raised in L.A.?
I was born and raised in L.A. First down in South L.A. until I was five. Then I moved to another suburb, Pico Rivera, small little incorporated town. Mm-hmm. That's where I was raised most of the time until my age. At the age of 17, you know, a cop took me home and said, sign for him to get off the streets. He'll end up dead or in prison. Ah. So did, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me. The cop saved my life. I ended up going into the Army. 2 months after my 18th birthday, I landed in South Vietnam, and where I had a year full of combat, and it was right at the beginning of the Tet Offensive. It was nasty. It was ugly, but it matured me, gave me a new outlook on life, made me want to do other things. And when I finally got out of the Army, all I wanted to do really was I wanted to become a cop. Because it was a cop that saved my life. And I want to be able to give back what he gave to me.
Mm-hmm. So you still had that envisioned in your mind that he saved your life, so you wanted to try to do maybe do the same for someone else.
Exactly. I was close, and that's what I wanted to do. My second, I had a second goal, and that was to go to college, because at that time I thought just rich white people went to college. Nobody in my family ever gone. I didn't know nothing about college because I was no good in high school. And I realized that when I knew I was mature, because I sent for my high school transcripts. And it's a good thing that I was a combat veteran. It was kind of mandatory. They had to let me into community college because I was embarrassed when I looked at my transcripts, and I obviously thought D stood for damn good. And F was fabulous. I got a couple of Fs in there. And the only thing I ever got an A in was music. You know, I was in a band. I was a saxophone player, and I loved it. It's the only thing I ever did good.
Now, I mean, were you a troubled kid? Do you think you agree with that cop? Were you headed down the wrong path?
I certainly was. I was hanging around with a bunch of guys on the corner, just like you see. You know, in general, we weren't bad guys. But, you know, if there was a fight, everybody would go to the fight. Dope was just starting to come out. The cop that saved me says he swore he caught me. I was right in the middle. I was running away from stealing my first hubcaps. One of my buddies he lost a leg in a drive-by shooting. So there was trouble brewing.
Right.
And we did it without our parents. We just hang out on a block and get in trouble. And so I was headed nowhere quick.
Okay. So what kind of action did you see in Vietnam? And you said it was right in the heat of things. I mean, you just got dropped off, worst case scenario type deal.
Yeah, it was. I didn't get dropped off. I was actually a crew chief. Just like when you become a cop, they give you a gun and you sign for it. It's yours.
Right.
When I got to my unit, they gave me a helicopter. I signed for it. It was mine.
Oh, wow.
So I did. I was crewing. So we'd go in and we'd do troop insertions, extractions, medevacs, resupply, mail, everything. Drop off ammunition up in the top of the hills, you know, where they had these small encampments, artillery companies up in the hills, and troops in where the fighting was going on. So I did that for about 6-7 months. And then I just changed uniform. I didn't change uniform. I just changed units. Same company. But then I went to flying crew chief on Avenger gunships, where now you're not extracting, you're not doing anything. Your job is just to go out there and pour a bunch of lead. We had rockets, miniguns, and freewheeling M60s. And so
did you adapt? I always find that interesting. Like someone, you know, that kind of gets dropped off when shit's really hitting the fan, I guess, so to speak. Did you adapt, you know, pretty quickly to that? I mean, I guess in a sense, you don't have a choice.
Yeah, you don't have a choice. You adapt. Everybody takes care. You become brothers. You really do. You become brothers with your combat. There is no color.
Right.
You know, no black, white, or you're all brothers in combat.
Yeah.
You fight and you want to survive. And it's just like, you know, I was asked on George Lopez on the show one time, he talked to me about smoking weed. And I said, George, I don't smoke. And he says, no, man. But, you know, hey, it's legal now. You know, I said, well, it's not that it was illegal. I said, you could buy a pack of Cools. If you could get into town, you could buy a package of Cools that was all weed. They were rolled up, you know, and they were cheap. And it was so easy to buy. Just go in there and buy them. Nobody cared about everything you were doing. Well, that was fine for everybody else. I didn't care about everybody else, but nobody in my helicopter, because I want to fly up, I want to land. You're not going to get on my bird if you're loaded. And so I didn't. And then when I got back, you know, weed was a felony when I first started. When I was first working as a cop, weed was a felony. Mm-hmm. And you get busted with one joint, that's a felony. And so things changed, and I'm not a prude. I don't care who smokes weed. It doesn't bother me. I don't care if my kids ever told me that they're – now they don't, but if they did, it wouldn't bother me that they were smoking it. Mm-hmm. They drink. I drink. I'm sure that I've been drunk enough to stand up to anybody smoking weed. I don't care. I just never done it.
Right. Just wasn't your thing.
Yeah.
Now, did you, and I will we'll go on past this, but I'm just curious, in, you know, that type of combat, did you ever have anybody that froze up, that just kind of couldn't take it? I mean, did you run across that?
Yes. Yes, I did. And he learned his lesson, and we got into it with fists. In essence, you'd say I beat the shit out of him.
Yeah.
My job was to go in there and pick up 4 soldiers that were down on the ground, and there was heavy shooting going on all around us. And so there was a transmission, and in those D&H helicopters, the crew chief and the gunner sat facing the outside.
Right.
And we couldn't see each other because the transmission was in between us. So he'd lean forward, look around, but I couldn't see if he had a passenger next to him, and he couldn't see if I had a passenger next to me. Our mission was pick up four guys. We had three, and the pilot's yelling, the aircraft commander says, "Do we have four?" And my gunner's yelling, and they all entered on his side. He said, "We got four." And I looked, I said, "We've got three." And he said, "No, we've got four." And the aircraft commander just said, "God damn it, we have three or four." And he says, "We've got four." And they came on his side, said, "All right, you know, I'm not going to say anything." He said, "We've got four." We got up, and when we went to go drop these guys off, we only had three. And so that meant another helicopter had to go in there and pick another guy up. And this guy that was calling the four, he just panicked.
Yeah, he was ready to get out of there.
And so I made him well aware of the fact that we didn't have time to panic. And so he left the unit that night. And there was no more.
I think your message was received.
It certainly was, and it was good for everybody that it was. And right. I remember a dear friend of mine, and we did a reunion. I cried when I saw him. When I went to gunships, where all we're doing is shooting up, and we had free 60s, so I'm controlling them. But when you just like sticking it, if you stick your hand out the window on a car, well, the wind's blowing back against you. Well, when I'm hanging out doing that helicopter, that shooting into the M60, the wind's blowing the chain links, the links that hold the rounds together.
Right.
It's ejecting them out the right side. Well, that wind is blowing them right back.
Yeah.
And got jammed. And so you go in and you say, okay, go hot. And that means start shooting. Well, the link got caught in there now, and you'd make a daisy chain. Well, we're on the opposite side. There's another helicopter coming in shooting up, and you just make that chain. Well, we go around the second crew time, and I wasn't ready. I hadn't got my gun unjammed. And when we landed that day, this little pilot came up to me and he called me every name in the book and said he could not rely. You know, we didn't have time to panic up there. We each depended on each other to stay alive. And I didn't say one word back to him because everything he said was absolutely right. But it was my first mission. I didn't realize how to unjam that gun because the barrel is hot. You know, wasn't prepared for it. And that was the last time the gun jammed. Everything he told me was correct. So a couple of years ago, we actually had a reunion in Phoenix. First time 53 years I had seen him. And when we got to see each other, we hugged and we cried. And it was beautiful.
Well, I'm glad you made it back. You make it back. You become a cop. You know, what are some, before we get into, you know, obviously the details here with Richard, what were some of the close calls? Because I can imagine, and this is what year we're talking when you became a cop in L.A.?
I became a cop in 1971.
1971. And what part of L.A. is it?
Through the academy. I actually, you know, you graduated in 72, the early part of 72. I went to work inside the jails because new cops go to the jails and the sheriff's department.
Okay. And
then in 1974, I transferred to my first patrol station.
What jail was it?
Jail was the oldest jail they got down there. It's even closed down now. It was the Hall of Justice Jail.
Oh, okay.
It was built, I want to say, back in 1925.
Wow.
Or even before then. It got closed down because of the earthquake. The building was made with a bunch of asbestos.
Ah.
And they were afraid it was going to leak and cause health problems. And they evacuated everybody out of that building, including the sheriff. And they left the detective bureau, you know, a homicide bureau and another detective bureau in there. And they got all the inmates out of on top. They left us in there. And I'm saying, this is bullshit. You know, so they finally got us all out of there. And that's when we left the building. I went to East Los Angeles Patrol, which back in the 70s was probably gangland USA.
Right.
It was all Mexican gang territory. And it was a rough station to work.
Is that like La M.A. and
some of those other guys? Well, M.A. hadn't even started yet. But all those are, M.A. was a prison gang that started in prison. These were all local gangs, all cut by territory. You know, they had El Loyo, which means there was a big hole, and that was called El Loyo. They had Little Valley, that was the name of their gang. Maravilla for Beautiful View. You know, everybody had their own gang names, and it was all turf wars, drive-by shooting, killings, it was nasty out there. Matter of fact, back when he was first beginning, I had Geraldo Rivera ride around with me. He was doing a Nightline special, so he was out there for a couple of weeks, and he rode around with me in a gang car for a while.
I watched, I've watched it, you know, a long time ago, multiple times, a great movie, but American Me with Edwards James.
Sure. Olmos. Yes.
And they had a podcast where they were interviewing a lot of people that, you know, had starred in the movie. And man, a lot of people got taken out because of that movie. I mean, like, they took that serious.
Eight people involved in the making of the movie got killed, got murdered.
Yeah.
Including a female. Mm-hmm. That was a gang counselor. She was something yep. in gangs.
And allegedly, I can't say that it's 100% true, but I've heard stories. Allegedly, apparently had, you know, a price on him, and he paid some money and things got squashed. But that whole thing, I was, you know, looking into it. One of the guys that was, you know, high up the rankings, Morgan, Joe, they called him Peg Leg. And he's not even Mexican.
Yeah. Yeah. Peg Leg Joe.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a strange concept. And I had a talk with, you know who Joey Torres is?
No, I don't know Joey Torres.
He run, what is it, the 18th Street Crew?
Okay, no.
Yeah, he was in jail for a long time. He was an amateur boxer, shot a guy, kind of got a raw deal as far as the sentencing because he was about to get out. They changed something. He was in jail for like 40 years. But got out. He was in there with a lot of those, like Sirhan, Charles Manson, a lot of those guys. How long in your career until you first encountered cases that were involved with the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez?
Okay. I worked patrol, and part of that patrol, I was working gang units. You know, I was working gangs because I had a gang background and I knew how to talk to the gang members. Right. So I was handpicked to work start a plainclothes gang unit in East LA.
Okay.
And I did that. And then I started the guys from Homicide, which was my dream job because that was creme de la creme. And then normally on our department, takes a minimum of 15 years to get there.
Wow.
And you could work any other detective, you know, you could work robbery, burglaries, you know, auto theft, child abuse, you can, any other detective job, but Homicide took minimally 15 years. Mm-hmm. Well, I got wind that they were looking at me because they'd started a gang Homicide unit up there. And all the guys working Homicide knew who I was and where I was at. So I got called. I had 9.5 years in. They called me up and said, hey, you're being transferred up to Homicide Bureau. And I went batshit. That was March the 23rd of 1981. My wife knew that I wanted to go to Homicide in the worst way. I screamed. She came running in. She says, what is it? And I said, I just got transferred into Homicide Bureau. And she says, when do you go? And I said, I don't know. I didn't even ask. I'm so excited for not to ask. And so I had to call back and find out. This was Friday, and I was there effective on Sunday.
And wow. So
that's when the transfer took effect. And that was March 23rd of 1981. And my first day actually in there was a Monday, which was the 23rd of March. And totally different world. I'm used to being structured and regimented. And now you're going up with the big boys where it's anything but structure and regimentation. Right. You work whatever hours you have to work to solve the case. Right. And I thought I was going to get dumped on because I hadn't paid my dues yet. You know, I was a youngster. When I went up there, they called me the kid, and I was the youngest guy up there for about 7 years. I was the kid. And so up there back in the day, we worked off of beepers.
Yeah.
So if you weren't at work, if you weren't in the office, they couldn't see you. Then they just paid you. I don't care what time it was. They paid you and say, this, you got a case, and they'd give you the information. Well, I had worked gang murders for the first couple of years that I was there, 2-3 years. And then they said in 85, we're bringing you up to work regular murders. Mm-hmm. And I was excited about that because working gang murders, it was always the same thing. You'd get there, there'd be paramedic debris, maybe a casing or two. Nobody wants to talk to you. Nobody saw nothing. And like taking sand to the beach, you know,
yeah,
just got older. So you had to work them hard and you knew your next case was going to be just as difficult. So that's the reason they formed a gang team, because before guys were getting a case and they get a case like that and they wouldn't get any help. So they just let it down. Give me my next case. Now, when you're working gangs, there was no next case. Next case would be just like this case.
Right.
So they got more solve rate. But then they just told me, we're wasting your talents. You're coming up to work the regulars. So I worked the regular murders. And that was in, I started in January of 85. And it was March the 17th of 85 that I caught the first case. It turned out to be the beginning of the Night Stalker case.
Because it was a while before they pieced it together, because he had a ton of names. Like the, I think one was the Diamond Knot Killer. I mean, it was a couple of different mantras before they finally just gave him the Night Stalker.
Yeah, that was all the news media. We never give him a name. They'd call him up. They say, you have a name. They say, yeah. What are you calling him? Calling him a suspect. Yeah, that's all we would do.
Got to sell papers.
Yeah, the Night Stalker, he liked it. So he kept the Night Stalker name. And in the beginning, for the first few months, because of my education and background, I was trying to tell these guys it's one man doing it, and nobody believed in it. And I could understand, it's really totally understandable why they didn't.
Why did you think that?
I had taken a couple of classes, a couple of semesters at Cal State LA on advanced criminal investigation pertaining to sex crimes. Mm-hmm. And there were things that I learned in that case, in that class, that I could see it he was doing, but unless you took the class, you'd never see it. You'd never understand it. Like when somebody points a gun at your face, are they really getting ready to kill you? No. Mm-hmm. The guy puts a gun in some lady's face, he's not going to kill her. What he's really looking for, he wants to see the fear in her.
Right.
And the fear is foreplay to sex. Mm. So it's a sexual thing. And what he was doing was sexual. And if you acquiesced, you lived. And if you didn't, you died. And he was killing the males that would get they were the blocking of him getting to his lust for women. So mm-hmm. eliminate the problem, and then you got the women. And what the public didn't know, and we kept out of the public's eyes, he kidnapped 5 or 6 kids and sexually assaulted them and let them go. In the Netflix documentary, one of the kids that was there is in the documentary. She's now in her family. Right.
I remember seeing that part of it. I think you, didn't she, she kind of confided in you as far as like coming on there and talking about it, right?
She, you know, I told the people from the documentary that I wouldn't help them find anybody.
Right.
Surviving victims and family members and witnesses had been through enough. What they found on their own was their business, but I wouldn't help them. And then I got called. They said, we found this one lady. She would like to talk to you first. And it was Anastasia Aronis. And so I called her up, talked to her, cried. I never wanted to follow up on any of the kiddie cases because I love children.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to find out that they had psychological problems. And so I talked to her, and she didn't. She's just as beautiful, just as sharp as she was as a kid. She was a parent of 3. She was a physical therapist, as was her husband. They had a place. They were residing down in San Diego. So it was beautiful. And I told her, don't do it because of me. You know, you listen to them. If you want to do this, do it. I answered some questions for her. Then the next thing I know, they're calling me back. They said, she's agreed to do it, but she wants you on the set. So I went and I saw her for the first time since she was a kid, and again, embraced her and cried. And she said, I wanted to talk to you so badly over the years, but I didn't know what we would say because I was only 6 years old at the time. And, you know, you're a much older man. So I didn't, what am I going to say? What do we have in common? And so we talked, and she's just a beautiful lady.
Now, you say you didn't keep in contact with, you know, some of the younger kids, and that's understandable. I mean, especially your passion for children. What about any, you know, some of the surviving ones that did survive, Richard? Did you keep in contact with any of them throughout the years?
No, I've kept in touch with a couple of family members, but not much. That's because they reached out to me. Right. Wouldn't reach out to anybody, but if they reached out to me, I'd certainly give them a call and talk to them. I even broke bread with one of them.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you're picking up pretty quick that you think this is a one man deal. Did you meet a lot of resistance for that from the other guys in the department?
Oh, I sure did. Not only the department, right in the middle of this thing, there was a psychologist, supposed to be a world-renowned psychologist from New York and one from UCLA out here, that said this one-man theory was full of hot air. Mm-hmm. No one man would be doing the things that we were alleging. And I didn't get mad at anybody because this criminal profiling that the FBI is known for, they based everything on criminal history. And nobody in criminal history has ever been known to do what I was alleging.
Wow. So now when the first case, obviously it probably took you guys, I'm sure, a few cases to realize these are connected.
It took, when I first started looking, I connected it early. March 17th, that's when we had Dale Okazaki and Maria Hernandez. Maria Hernandez survived, and I sent a staff artist out there so she could tell him what the guy looked like. So he drew a drawing. Mm-hmm. He gave it to me, and he said, this is what she said he looked like. Physical description coupled with a drawing. And one of the other detectives from their crime lab said, Gil, hold that thought. He went out to his car, and he said, in January, I had a 12-year-old girl. There was an attempted kidnapping. And here's the drawing on her. And his was not a freehand drawing. His was what we used to use in the old days. It was called an identikit. These acetate lines, they put them over, put it on a Xerox machine, and then now you got a picture of what the guy looked like. You could give him different noses, high cheeks, hair, anything you wanted to.
Right.
And they looked identical. So that made me start thinking. Now, on the 29th of March, one of the other guys got a case there in the same vicinity, and it had a shoe print that was very distinct. Now, that shoe print showed up at a couple of cases, and that shoe print did a study on it, and I can tell you without equivocation today that on January 9th, 1985, 1,356 pair model 440 Avias entered the United States from Taiwan in New York, and for distribution throughout the U.S., six pair ended up in the state of California, one pair ended up in L.A., and they were black. Most of them were white. These were black, and that's what made them unique. So when that shoe print shows up and starts showing up at different locations, there's another piece of evidence. Circumstantial may be, but it's a piece of evidence. So when you get physical descriptions coupled with that, looks like the same guy.
Right. Was that the incident? And I want to pick up on that shoe thing in a minute, but was that, it was the first person that he killed. Was that one where he was in the garage? And I think one of them hid in the house, but I thought he was gone and came out a little too early.
That was Dale Okazaki and Maria Hernandez on the 17th. Right. Dale Okazaki and her were roommates in a condo. Mm-hmm. Dale was already home. Yep. And Maria Hernandez came in. He made a deliberate noise, slapped the top of a vehicle. He was on a carpet runner, slapped the top of the vehicle so she could turn around and see him when he came point shoulder. He could have popped her in the head. He didn't. He wanted her to see him.
He wanted that fear.
Exactly. So he fired. And as soon as he fired, everything went black because she had just hit the garage door closer and it would hit the button. Timing took 8 seconds from the time he hit the button to the time it closed. And it was pitch black. And he tells me later on, he says, shit, I thought I was dead. Because the ringing of the gun, he saw the sparks go out, she went down to the ground, and then it turned black. And he says, shit, I thought I was dead. And he realized he wasn't dead, so he just opened the door because she had already unlocked it, pushed her body out of the way somewhat, and then he got up and went inside. Maria, who's not dead, was holding a pair of her keys to the car in her hand. The bullet struck the key, went inside her hand, and didn't exit. So she got up, hit the button, went around the alleyway from her garage door around to the front, because as she's going, she hears a gunshot inside the condo, and she knows she has Maria in there, or Dale, excuse me. And when she went around, she expected Richard to exit the garage door like he came in. He exited the front door. And he saw her, she saw him. They played cat and mouse around a car that was parked right there in front of the condo. Finally, Maria just threw up her hand. She wasn't in fear anymore. threw up her hands and said, "Hey, you already shot me once. Don't shoot me again." He put the gun down by his side and walked away. Did not shoot her, did not run. He walked away. And then 40 minutes later, he killed another girl, probably about 2 miles away from there, Silene Yu.
So did he tell you why he didn't kill her? Was it because she kind of had that attitude about it?
No, we in talking to him, I asked him early on, why didn't you kill Maria? And I said, was it because she was Mexican? Or was it because she looked exactly like her sister? She looked exactly like his sister. And he just said, yeah. That's all he said.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, like, I'm putting myself in a, I'm not saying I would do this. I'm putting myself in a criminal mind. You know, you would think you don't want to leave any witnesses. But it was very odd, the choosing of how he would let some people live and then the others he would take out. It was quite.
If you asked, you lived. If you didn't, you died.
Wow. Now, the shoe print that you guys found, how long were, and I'm curious of like how long it took for stuff to get back to you back in those days. Cause now I feel like that's information that you could probably get, you know, within a few hours, maybe a day or so max. How long was it? Did it take you guys to find it, to manufacture? How many were shipped? The one got shipped to LA, the color. How long did that take?
Once we got onto it, I got a guy from our crime lab that had been lifting, making caster pass, plaster castings of the shoe print itself. And his job was working that shoe print. Went up to him one day, and he was relatively new in the crime lab. And I was known then, you know, I was always joking around. I was always lying. I was a BSer, just having fun. And I went up to him and said, "Jerry, we're sending you up to Oregon today." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Yeah, we found out, this shoe. We found out, who manufactured it and who has a patent on it. And so you're going up there." So we sent him up there. He said, "When do I go?" I said, "You're going this afternoon." I reached in my pocket and give him a wad of money. I said, "Go." And he came back with all the distribution papers, everything, including a pair of Avia shoes for me. You know, so we got some Avia shoes out of it and met Mr. Stubblefield.
And now I don't want to speak ill of anyone because I think she has passed on, but Diane Feinstein. Why? I can't, like, that is what you guys have the smoking gun right there, because if you can catch him even not in the act, but just in general, and he's got these shoes on, like, that is rock solid information. What in the hell was this lady thinking to release that to the public? I mean, what was that?
I'm just glad she never heard from my lips every name that I called her.
Oh, yeah.
She did it. And my displeasure. And we were just coming back from San Francisco because we had gone up there because of the case they had. We just flew in. We're walking into the office, and our news media section said, "Hey, guys, come in here. I think you ought to see this." And we walk in there to see the press conference that she's holding and what she's putting out. And we went upstairs. I was thoroughly disgusted. And I just told my partner, I said, "Screw this place. Let's get out of here. May as well go fishing. Let's go have a drink." And we walked out. And I went down to our office was in Chinatown, right in downtown L.A. So we went to a local distributor of spirits, sat down and found my captain in there. And I didn't know that he used to drink down there. My partner knew, but I didn't. And so we went down there, got a drink. And we told him how pissed off we were. And he had to get to our boss, the sheriff of Los Angeles County, to let politicians know to stay out of our case. This is, we may as well go fishing, boss. This is ridiculous. So we talked him into going and contacting the boss, the sheriff. And about a half hour later, he called us back. He said, "Okay, stop drinking, get some food in you, and be back at the office at 8 o'clock tonight." The sheriff, they flew him in because he had been out in Lancaster to parade a festival or something out there. So they flew him in, they got him in here to us, and he held a press conference where he condemned politicians for getting involved in her case. And because one particular politician, and he never mentioned her by name, he said, but recently a politician gave out information that was crucial to the investigation, and now it's been blown. So stay out. And he told her handlers, if she opened her trap again, he would embarrass her. And So that was the end of that.
What was she? What was her position?
She was the mayor of San Francisco at the time. And we gave a flyer for police only to the San Francisco cops. Somehow they gave it to their boss and their boss gave it to her.
That was what I was going to ask, is how she, and I don't know as, you know, as far as who's privy to what kind of information, but I was curious of how she got it. I mean, was it a re-election? I mean, what, somebody had to sign off for, maybe I'm assuming, write that speech. Like, I don't understand how they could think that was a positive thing, especially if they knew the rarity. Like, that's giving away.
You know, I remember one of the guys, the guy that did the shoe print study, Jerry Burke, said, he's recording and he's saying, you know, what was she thinking? Not even, you know, it doesn't take much imagination to know that the information she was giving out was sensitive. And Richard tells us he threw a gun and the shoes over the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh yeah. That night. Didn't he say he did it that night or right? Yeah. Cause you know, he's watching it. I just, that part of the case, man, had me baffled of why she would do this. And that was another thing that was like, you know, so many things went right for Richard. It's crazy to say that when he killed so many people, but he had so many close calls that, sure, you know, he got away with. And there was another instance where, how did you guys come upon the dentist appointment?
He got, there was a car that got pulled over. It was an attempt kidnapping of two kids up in LA City's area, their jurisdiction. And that car, they had to go over a little hill, a little loop-de-doop, to get on the freeway on-ramp there, and a motor officer stopped him. And the motor officer stopped him, and what Richard tells us later is he threw a bag of shit over into the bushes as he was getting stopped. And the motor officer came up to him, patted him down, and then he went back to his motor. And as he's getting his sight book, because he's going to write this guy for running a red light, Richard could hear over the speaker box on a motorcycle, you know, attention all cars, attempt kidnapping just occurred, and give a vehicle description. And that's the car that Richard's in. Richard drew a pentagram with his finger on the hood of the car because he had his hands all over that car. And then all of a sudden, Richard said, I just took off, went running. And that officer allegedly went running after him, but wasn't going to catch him. Richard said, he never took a step in my direction. You know, he didn't. In that car, he left a little plastic business card holder. It was a cheapie. Richard said he left a $100 bill in there, and there was a business card from this dentist. Now, this we get from Richard after the fact.
Right.
But that thing, once we heard about the stop, we went ahead and contacted LAPD. We wanted to talk to Officer Starvos. And Starvos heard we wanted to talk to him, and he called in. So he didn't come in. So it took us a couple of days. By this time, the sun had baked everything off that car. The car was useless. But they found this business card holder in there. And so the guys from LAPD said, hey, we did find this. And there's a business card made out to Richard Mena. And there's a dentist in Chinatown. So, which is just a couple of blocks, 2-3 blocks away from our building. So we went down, contacted the good doctor. Good doctor said, yeah, well, I have this guy that comes in here, and described him. And it sounded like maybe the guy that we were looking for, and said, okay, we're able to get a copy of his x-rays. He gave them to me, and I took him to a good, very good friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine that was a dentist. And I asked him, what can you tell me about looking at this guy's teeth? He said, well, he's got an impacted tooth. He says, he's not going to be able to last much longer. This thing's got to be killing him. He'll be back to that dental office soon. So we put two guys on the inside of the dental office and waited for him to come back. These guys were making more money. They were working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. They're making bank. And Richard didn't come back.
They're just hanging out in the lobby?
Exactly. That's all they're doing.
Reading magazines.
And so one of the executives on my department took it upon himself to make the decision. He says, call those guys out of there. It's a waste of our money. Let's just put LAPD, because it was LAPD's jurisdiction there, have them put in one of their silent alarms in the building. And if he gets there, hit the alarm, they'll respond immediately and get him that way. All right. So we did it. Our executive told us to. The day they pulled that damn thing out, the day we pulled our guys out, they put the robbery alarm in there. That night, about 9 o'clock at night, I get a phone call from the dentist, all excited. Where were we? How come nobody went down? I said, what are you talking about? The alarm didn't work. It was malfunctioning. Rich had been in there that day.
So that's what I'm saying, man. Like, yeah. So many things happened to help aid, you know, him to keep doing what he was doing. And I mean, would you consider him, looking back on it now, would you consider him more like cunning or just lucky?
Lucky. Lucky. He was cunning at the point of operation when he's committing a murder. He was good. He was good at what he did. But aside from that, he was lucky.
Yeah. Like, as far as like covering his tracks and stuff like that, I mean, he was seen quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He knew he was getting hot. He told me. He said, I was getting tired. I knew I was going to get caught. I said, I knew you were.
It had to be. I mean, mentally, it has to wear on you. And I mean, I would think that you've even said too in the documentary, you know, you hate to think like this, but you're so close. You want another incident to happen or another murder to happen because he's going to leave a clue. Was that really your mindset going?
Oh, yes. Yes. I asked my partner with Frank Salerno, who had worked on the Hillside Strangler, which was another serial killer case. And I asked him one day, I said, Frank, is it wrong? Is it wrong for me to be thinking that, God, I wish he'd hit again? Because I want that. He's got to screw up. I one more piece of evidence. Give me one more clue. I was hungry. And I was never home. My captain is quoted in the Times saying we were working 7 days a week, 16, 18 hours a day, you know, which is a violation of federal law, but right. We were working it. We didn't care.
How's that affecting your home life?
My wife moved out of the house with the kids for a while. She was frightened because I was not home and she knew what was going on. And so she moved out. She took the kids and went, she would either be at my family's house or her family's house, which made me feel better because they were better in numbers.
Right.
And, but it broke my heart. I remember one day calling up and, my wife told me I caught my daughter crying in the room. I said, what was she crying about? And she said nothing. And I said, no, you're crying for a reason. What's wrong? And she said, I just want my dad home again.
Oh man.
So I just want my dad. And that just tore me up on the inside. I wanted to cry. I said, I got to go. I hung up. And as soon as I hung up, I started cussing. I'm sitting there saying, why does she tell me this stuff right now? I don't need more pressure. I don't need extra. And what I didn't realize after the documentary showed, I apologized and asked her for forgiveness. I didn't realize how frightened she really was. I had factored everything else out, but I never factored in the fright. And I was packing a gun and I had friends, so I wasn't worried.
Right.
But
what it was? That was kind of the catalyst to get her to move, was she was scared. And I'm assuming, yeah. Were you in the news at this time? Did they know you were on this case? Sir. Okay. Yeah. So she's worried that you know, if he knows you're out there looking for him, then you're not home. You know, yeah. So that's probably her mode of thinking.
Yeah. And he knew exactly who we were first time we laid eyes on him. He knew I was Gil. He knew he was Frank.
And you know, like, I don't know, but I'm thinking the way he was, the way his mind worked, I would think maybe he had a boundary of he probably wouldn't do that because he respected y'all trying to catch him. Even though he was killing half of L.A., I think he wouldn't do that.
You get to know him, and his dad was a cop at one time. Yep. But he was a cop in Juarez. And I mean, and you could be selling ice cream one day, and then you know somebody, you're a cop the next day. So it was no big deal. But his dad was a cop. And so Richard told us, he talked to him, he's captured on the 31st, which was a Saturday. Mm-hmm. So you go back on Wednesday, he was actually cited by LAPD. He was on a motorcycle and he got a ticket because he didn't have a motorcycle license. So as one cop is writing the tickets, got his nose in the book, writing it, the other cop was standing on a sidewalk talking to people going by, just being friendly. And Richard told him, he says, you ought to tell him to be more careful. He says, that cop on the outside missed a gun. I had a gun in my crotch and he missed it. It'd have been very easy for me to shoot him. And I'm sitting there, well, there's a guy that wants to pass on a bit of information, help him out.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. It's crazy how the minds of, you know, psychopaths like that work. And, you know, we mentioned, obviously it was a strain on your marriage. You're never home. Your wife is scared. was it doing anything to you as far as like alcohol consumption or anything like that? Was it, you know, what kind of effects did it have on you?
We didn't have, I was consuming alcohol. Matter of fact, I can tell you right now, during that time period, I was drinking Jose Cuervo Gold. And you can have one drink or you can have, and you may as well have a dozen because it gives you breath of a camel's ass. And so I'd come home and my wife would sit there and say, working late. And I said, oh yeah, you wouldn't believe, you know, what's going on. And she'd go, no, probably not, because it smells to me like you've been drinking. And so I was drinking and I knew I was drinking. And right after the arrest, I stopped drinking cold turkey. I wanted nothing to drink. And I was 30 days dry. I hadn't touched a drop. And we went out to eat. We were invited by Channel 4, Laurel Erickson and her producer. We went to the taping of Johnny Carson show. And then we went out to dinner. And my wife and her were drinking. And I'm sitting across from him and Slurno and his wife are there. And all of a sudden, my wife starts crying. And Laurel Erickson asks, what's wrong, Crow? She says, what? Says, is it, since this case, he's a changed man. He's not the same way he was before. I said, look at him. He won't even have a drink with me. And number one, she wasn't a drinker. I was the drinker. But yet, now I wouldn't have a drink with her. I said, hey, wait a minute. Stop the madness. I said, number one, keep our personal business personal.
Yeah.
Number two, Laurel, I better not hear homicide detective headed for divorce court, film at 11. And I told the waiter, I said, bring me Cuervo Gold and on the rocks and don't let the rocks hit the bottom of the glass. Just keep them coming for a while. So I was drinking. I don't drink near as much, nothing like I used to drink. And then I stopped drinking liquor and I finally went to wine.
Yeah.
And that's my drink of choice. And I don't even drink that that often. But when I do, I buy wine by the case to keep it here at the house. You never know when you
go to wine.
And I still have right now. I've just changed brands. I got tequila in my freezer right now. So you never know when you're going to have company.
What's your favorite brand of wine? What's your go to wine?
I drink a lot of Josh. I drink it's all Cabernet. I don't like the whites.
Yeah.
I drink Cabernet or Merlot, either one of them. Josh Sellers or Joel Gott, you know, all about $15 to $20 wines. I've had, my buddy gave me, when I made lieutenant, he brought me a bottle. Oh, it'll come to me right now, name it, but it was $500 a bottle.
Ooh.
And I tasted it and I said, geez, it tastes like shit. I gave it all the way. I didn't like it. So, and I remember when I was in Vegas at a conference, one of the television stations took us out there looking for material to put out on their television. They took myself and a couple of investigators that I had with me. They took us out to dinner and they said, Gil, you pick the wine. So they gave me the wine list and I picked a $300 bottle of wine. And that wasn't any better than the $20 wine I drink on a regular basis.
Yeah. I have some guys that will tell me they pay like high dollar for the whiskey. And my go-to whiskey is Jim Beam Red Stag, which is like a black cherry. And I mean, it's $30 for a handle and I mix it with cherry Coke, vanilla Coke, all kind of stuff. And that's my go-to. And it's like $30 for that handle, which is, you know, on the cheaper side. And people say they're spending hundreds of dollars for this and $100 for that. And I'm just like, I love, you know, mine.
I'm not pretentious at all about what I drink. Look at my body. It look like I'm particular about much.
You know,
I went out to dinner with a judge one night, a female judge, and her husband was there, and my wife, and she brings her own bottles and have them corked right on. So, and she said, Gil, I got to have you taste this wine. I was drinking Coppola wine that night, and so I got it. And I said, all right, this is good. I said, but I'll be honest with you, Judge. I said, I'm really not that. I really don't care how high the dollar is on that wine because I drink some stuff at home that I keep at home that I buy at Costco. And it's called Ménage à Trois. And it's a blend. It's not a Cabernet. It's a blend. And so she says, I love it. She says, I have a case. That's my everyday wine at home. She was still, if she's drinking the stuff, that's what I drink.
Yeah.
And now I've just grown out of it and I'm into Joel Gott, Josh Sellers, or anything like that.
I go, people always ask me too, like, what beer you drink? I said, just whatever's on sale. I'm not. What would you say was the tipping point of, obviously, I mean, I know he got spotted and, you know, chased to the bus, but before that, what was the tipping point that was kind of like, your days are numbered?
We had said a week before his arrest, he hit down in Orange County. And the day before he hit, that was a Saturday, we told our captain, I said, hey, we'll have him in two weeks. We'll have him. And we had no idea who he was. But I said, give us 2 weeks. We'll have him. And we went down there. He hit down there and he told him, tell him the stalker was here. He liked that name. That's how he knew he liked the name. And then we recovered a car. He used a stolen car, brought it back to LA, found the stolen car. I wanted him to sit on the car, see if he'd go back and re-steal it, take it out for a ride. But once again, the executive said, no, just hook it up. So we hooked it up, went down to Orange County, and they found a print. He had moved the mirror, and they found a print on it. And the good thing about it, they were using laser equipment at that time. Mm-hmm. So as soon as they found it later, we told our sheriff, hey, they found it with this new laser. Went out and bought two of them right now. You got them. So we made a print and we sent it up to Sacramento. But during this time, understanding they didn't have DNA then and fingerprints weren't automated other than felony convictions. Mm-hmm. And we knew through an informant that the guy we're looking for had been arrested by LAPD the previous year for Grand Theft Auto. So we told them, see if you can find him. They said, no felons matching this print. They said, okay, we now have, our informant tells us his name is Ricky, Richard, or Ricardo. And they called him El Despeinado, nickname, moniker, the uncombed one. And at the same time, up in San Francisco, Carl Klotz and Frank Falzone up there got a guy by the name of Armando, and I want to say his last name was Rodriguez. I'm not even sure. Mm-hmm. But he was a friend of Richard's. That's who Richard used to go visit up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So they found him, and they got him to cop out to giving him a last name of Ramirez. So
pretty interesting story how they got that, too.
Oh, trust me. I'm glad I didn't know then. I found out on the Netflix documentary that it never would have washed.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, obviously I know he had done a ton of shit, so I don't think it would have been able to get the whole case thrown out. But for our viewers that maybe haven't seen the documentary or don't know what we're referring to, Mr. Klotz, I guess, apparently roughed this guy up pretty good to get that last name.
He hit him once, and he said now he's going to smash his face all up. And what the viewers don't understand, every cop knows that's been in the business a while, there's something that's called Fruits of the Poison Tree Doctrine. Mm-hmm. So anything found after that would have been eliminated as evidence. And fortunately, it was never brought up. Nothing ever came up. And the first time I heard about it, really, was when I watched the documentary. And I'm sitting there, what is he doing? Why? You know, it didn't bode well. But fortunately, he didn't get caught. We didn't get caught. And not really, other than the name. Now we told, okay, hand search Richard Ramirez in your, just manually search for the name in your files. And they found eight of them. And one of them matched the fingerprints that they had lifted out of Orange County. So that was it. But we had the fingerprint already. It was just a matter of working a little longer, and nothing we gained out of that really would have made that big a difference in the case.
Right.
But it did. They got it. We were grateful when we never asked how. They just said, hey, we got a name now. And not until I saw that in the Netflix. And I said, holy Jesus.
Wow.
That's not the way we work up here. Trust me.
So given the way it happened, I mean, I would say he was almost arrested by the citizens of LA, you know, with the assistance of obviously getting his identity out there in his picture, but kind of his capture was almost, I would say, like a citizen's arrest, but albeit a lot of them. Are you satisfied with that, or does a part of you wish maybe he'd have went out in a blaze of glory and you'd have got to take him out?
I had mixed emotions. I wanted him dead. Mm-hmm. But the other side of me wanted him alive because I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to spend time with him.
Yeah.
And so the way it happened, and they didn't arrest him. It was actually a combination of stuff. His picture was released. He's identified. He's a passenger on a bus. One of the passengers IDs him, gets off the bus at the stop. Richard sees him going for the phone. And the next intersection, Richard gets off the bus. First guy that saw him stopped a gas company truck and said, "Hey, follow that bus. The killer's on there." So they went following that bus. Then they started trying to stay up with Richard. Richard was jumping fences, going through things. And it was really difficult to stay up with him. He went on about a 2-mile sprint and all the way across the 5 freeway, you know, all 8 lanes of freeway. And then when he tried to carjack a car, the lady started screaming and her husband came out and got a piece of pipe and nailed him in the head. Well, 2 miles of sprinting and jumping fences, getting hit, and he's exhausted. And so when he did that, he then went ahead and tried running away. He only got about 4 houses. The rest of the neighbors saw him fighting with a neighbor over here. They went and they just encircled him. He just gave up, sat down, and they didn't put the boots to him. You know, they let it go, and they called the cops. Cops went down there. A cop car would have been arriving at a citizens holding a felony suspect. And when they did, he got there. He's probably one of the few cops in LA County that didn't have a picture of him in his car by now, didn't know who it was. And so he just saw the guy was bleeding in the head. They had him surrounded, handcuffed him, easy case, called paramedics. They put a turban on him, you know, to keep blood from going all over the place. And then the guys from LAPD showed up and they said, yeah, that because it was just a half a block outside their jurisdiction. Now he's in the county jurisdiction. So she's probably in the garage. Anyway, they hold him. He gets there, doesn't know who he is. LAPD comes up, and when they get there, they just go up and said, "That's the guy we've been chasing. Take him out of our car, put him in their car." And he said, "Get him out of here. Get him to the station." And this guy had no idea what had just happened to him. The young deputy was a new rookie, and the guys at the station, they wanted to kill our deputy because he said, "You just let the biggest arrest of the century go away. You lost, you piece of shit." And they made fun of him forever. They didn't even, it's kind of like common practice. There's nothing written. If I arrest somebody from an outside, you know, and he's wanted by them, they're going to take him. Well, what you do is just courtesy. Okay, give me your cuffs. I'll put them on him. I'll take mine off and I'll keep my cuff. They didn't even get a chance to take off his cuffs. Wow. They just took him with their cuff and took him down to the station.
And how did it make you feel when you got the phone call that you finally got him? What was your emotions like at the
time? I was so excited. I was already up out and about that morning. I probably had about 2-3 hours sleep, but I was back out on the streets when I got notified that he was in custody. And so I raced down over there, and then it was all business, just like, you know, Manning putting on his helmet, going out for a football game. Now it's,
okay,
it's crunch time now. Put everything, all your personal feelings aside.
One of the things that's really odd is Richard pictures of him like he is a scary dude. I can see to where he would inflict some fear into people. Like, you know, I've like to fancy myself as somebody that, you know, put in a situation could hold his own, but just actually laying eyes on somebody like that would freak me out a little, you know, looking at somebody like Richard.
You know, he didn't freak me out. He didn't do any of that stuff. Other people sat there and said, "God, weren't you scared going in there? You know, you knew he was into Satanism." And I said, "No, you know, it was game time. I knew my job. I knew what I had to do, and I couldn't let myself get emotionally taken away and lose everything."
Right.
So no, it was prime. I was ready.
Because, like, you know, looking at guys like Ted Bundy, who, you know, done a lot of gruesome stuff, I wouldn't, like, if I seen him in a dark alley, I would, you know, excuse me, sir, you know, going by, I wouldn't be, you know, scared at all. A lot of guys, I mean, Dennis Rader to a certain
sure. point,
you know, BTK looks like a guy, you looks like a professor or something at a high school.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of these guys don't look like what you would picture somebody that would do these kind of things would look like. Richard, however, does, at least in my opinion, that looks like somebody that I would picture.
People say, you know, I know all I ever said was he's nothing more than human.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't have to look evil just like he's, and especially Dennis Rader,
yeah.
you know, cause I got called to go over there and assist them, you know, give them some advice and help them along with the BTK case. And then about a month before I was due out there, he got arrested. And I called him up and said, well, I guess all bets are off. You don't need me anymore. And they said, no, we still want you to come out here because we still have the prosecution to go through. You can advise us on that. And not only that, we scheduled a seminar. Cops are coming from all over the state to listen to you talk about it. So it worked out good.
Well, an odd thing too is like he would get fan mail and what didn't he get married? Like women were just flocking at this dude. I'm like, we got good guys out here all over, and this guy's the one pulling these women here. He's in jail for life, killing all these people.
He married and he married the ugliest one that used to go down and visit him. He had some good looking women that would go visit him. You know, one gal I'll never forget sitting there in court, and I got to get up. They wanted me on the phone at the bailiff's desk. So I went to the phone and I'm looking at her, and he always looked at the ladies when he was either entering court or exiting court. And she was an attorney, no doubt. Her and her friend were both attorneys. They had their briefcases there, dressed to the tens. They were gorgeous. And as he came walking by, she intentionally spread her legs open and then blew him a kiss. And I went back and told my partner, I said, put hooks on me, see if it works for me too. Jesus.
It don't even make no sense. I just to fathom what women found attractive about this guy, considering all that he did.
I have no idea.
What do you think Richard reigns in, like, the, I guess I would say maybe hierarchy or infamy of all the serial killers from LA? Cause obviously you got the Zodiac, which, you know, was never really 100% confirmed, been solved. You did have Bundy was in that area a little bit.
Bundy was in the
area rapist.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you think he ranks up there, at least in like the California, you know, area? Where do you think Richard is on that?
He ranks up there very high in California. I don't know how he messes up throughout the U.S. The Son of Sam and the other one that dressed like a clown.
Gacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gacy. And the one that was eating his people.
Dahmer,
Leslie Dahmer. Those are some sick puppies. You know, they're up there. Richard didn't get into any of that.
Right. He was more, I don't know if blue collar killer is the right kind of terminology you can even use.
You know, and him and Bundy used to write to each other.
Really?
Yeah. Well, they were in custody.
Wow. I did not know that. Wow. That's crazy. When did you get approached for the Netflix documentary?
It aired in 21. So I probably got approached in 19 or 20.
And I'm assuming you got a nice little check for that too. Didn't you?
I got a healthy check in the beginning. They said, hey, this is what we want to do. This is what we'll give you. And I believe everybody gets off happy. And I was happy. I had no problem with it. I did tell them that I wouldn't. They said, here's our idea. Here's how we want to carry this thing. And I said, I don't care how you carry it. I'm not involved in that. You're the professional. They said, okay, well, when we're done filming, we'll get the editing. We'll call you up. See the edits, how it's going to go. And I said, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
I'll watch it when it drops like everybody else.
And the guy that done that, it's escaping me right now. What's his name?
Tiller Russell.
He done the 7-5 documentary.
He did the 7-5. He's done a couple of them. They're best documentaries I've ever seen.
Yeah. Waco. I think he done one of them on Waco. I mean, he's done a good bit, but that 7-5 documentary, man, that was the first time I seen that. I mean, my jaw was on the floor. It was very well done. And then, you know, the Netflix with y'all, the Night Stalker. I mean, it's like, it's not one of them things that you can just stop watching. You got to watch it all the way through.
Yeah. He did one operation and I can't remember what the last word is. And it's about a, Mexican cartel hiring a middleman to buy, submarines from Russia. And then over here for dope trafficking.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't that guy's name like Rambo or something like that? Didn't he call his name Rambo? It was a big guy that was buying it. Yeah. I remember watching that.
So he did that one, and he did one on the narcotic Kiki Camarena. Mm-hmm. The DEA agent got kidnapped and tortured. Another excellent. He does good work.
Yeah, he does great work.
He's just such a good guy. It's cool.
You mentioned going up there to assist with the BTK. Like, when this happened, you guys, you know, essentially you broke this case, you got Richard off the streets. You know, what kind of happens to your career at that point? You know, your life is consumed with catching this guy. You finally do catch him. I mean, you think like there's this huge light, a rainbow or pot of gold or something at the end of the tunnel. Is it just back to work the next day, on to the next thing?
Back to work the next day. I finished a Night Stalker case. My next case after that was a transit murder.
Wow. And I mean, I only asked this question because my wife and I actually watched, and I've seen it a lot of times before, but she was just kind of shocked. I think it was the first time she's seen it. You know, he spends this whole time, we watched Donnie Brasco. He spends this whole time undercover in the mob. And then at the end, they shake his hand and they gave him a check for $500. And she's like, is that all he got? And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I've ever spoken to him, but I'm like, at the end, that's a lot. It's years invested and you got $500. Now his is a little bit different than yours. Like now he's got to go into hiding, you know, cause there's probably a price on his head. Probably still is, you know, you're a little different. You're a cop. It was in the news. You were a cop, but does it do anything to you after that to be part of, you know, such a major case? And does it have perks as to people wanting you to come and help with other cases? Do you appreciate that? Or is it kind of
I got to go here. Makes you feel good. Cause people do ask for advice. When they called me for the BTK, it was just for an advisory capacity. Since the Netflix thing dropped, I've spoken all over this U.S.
Right.
Major colleges, universities. And just 2 weeks ago, I got an invitation to go to Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Wow.
And I've spoken and you name it. And it's been good. And there's been other documentaries and we just finished making a film. So it's been good.
Tell us about the film that you got coming?
Yeah. This thing is going to be, it's going to be entitled Hubbard Street, which is the street that Richard actually is captured on. And it's very, very loosely based surrounding the Night Stalker case. It's really about gang members and lowriders in East Los Angeles. Okay. And that's where he's captured at. So that's where it culminates. And what started out to be a cameo appearance ended up getting the speaking part of the movie.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Well, look, you got an expected drop date on that?
It was supposed to be, they figured they'll finish editing around June, May or June. And then because September is Hispanic Heritage Month, they're going to try and sell it to AMC. If not, it'll go to film festivals because it's that's the kind of movie it is.
Right. You know, looking back on everything, this kind of, I guess, will be a two-parter question. Is there something that you beat yourself up about had you acted on one particular thing or one particular hunch that may have closed this sooner? Or are you satisfied with how things played out?
I'm satisfied. It's too bad my colleagues couldn't see what I did in the beginning, but I'm very satisfied for my part. Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have anything that haunts you from your time, you know, tracking him down?
No. Now that my wife just entered the house, I can tell you my wife haunts me, but aside from that, nothing.
Now, I'm assuming that, you know, you said she moved out after the Night Stalker was caught. I'm assuming, come on back in. Do you have to rope her back in?
He was arrested on the 31st. My cousin was getting married that day, and my daughters had something to do with the wedding. And it was at the Pasadena Hilton. Okay. So I just told her, take the kids. I'll catch up with you there later on. And when I told her, I said, it's over with. He's caught. And I affectionately call her Sister Mary Clarence. She's very religious. She's a nice lady. And she says, what do you mean he's caught? Why isn't he dead? You know, and so it caused my grief. And I walked in that night to the, caught up with her, walked into the hotel. And I could hear people as I was walking by saying, that's him. That's the guy. That's him. That's him. And I found my mother and my sisters. And we all embraced and everybody was crying. And I said, where's my wife? They said, she went up to the room. She'll be right back down. They went and they called her. She came down and we embraced. And I said, I need a drink. Went to the bar and I went to pay for a drink. Somebody that I don't know just said, hey, drink's on me. thank you for what you did. I said, well, thank you. The bartender said, hey, anytime you come up to this bar, if you don't have a sponsor, the bar sponsors you. And he says, your money's no good here tonight. I said, thank you. I went around, went up to my cousin, congratulated him. Then I told my wife, you know what? I'm tired. And this is not my night. It's my cousin's night. So I just want to go up to the room. And one of my daughters said, can I go with you? I'm tired too. So we went upstairs and spent the night there. And next day I was back to work.
Wow. How many conversations did you have with Richard after he was captured?
After he was captured, we probably had three conversations with him, at least three, if not four. And then after his conviction, we spent 3 days with him.
3 days?
Yeah. Not full days. We'd go down and visit, spend a couple of hours. Matter of fact, there was a there was a made-for-TV movie.
Right.
He couldn't watch it because he was in trouble. He'd done violated something in the jail. And so at homicide, we get pretty much anything we wanted. So we got a copy of it. We went down and pulled him out, put him in a room, and we watched it with him.
Do you think he had a sense of pride watching it?
He said he liked the guy that played the actor's last name was Cruz. I don't remember his first name. He was an unknown actor, but he played Richard. And it was funny because he spent some time with me before the movie. He came to my house and we talked about what Richard was really like. And he said that he knew that I'd be on the set when they were making it. He said, you just want to warn me in advance. He was a method actor. And so if he's in the character, he wouldn't be smiling at me. He wouldn't say hello. He wouldn't do anything. He's just in the character. I said, it's okay. I fully understand because I'm a method cop. If I see you, don't be surprised if I slam your ass up against the wall and rehook you. And we just laughed. But Richard said that the guy played a pretty good part. He didn't think that they'd ever find anybody that could be as sinister as he was. And he says the guy did good.
Yeah, I think Lou Diamond Phillips played him in one movie too. But I mean,
Lou Diamond Phillips played him in another movie.
Yeah.
And
is there anything that he said to you in y'all's conversations that was like bone chilling?
No, he was. Talking to him was just like talking to you. He really was. I mean, we would talk, we'd laugh sometimes. It was very serious. And I had objectives. You know, I knew I wanted information. I had to do whatever I had to do in order to get the job done.
So what was the job at this point, being that he's caught, he's convicted? What was your job here? Figuring out other cases that hadn't been linked to him?
Exactly. Figuring out other cases that I'm going to face in the future. What was going through his mind. And he told us that last day that he was good for four more murders that we weren't aware of. And we didn't tell him, but we were actually looking at eight more murders. But there wasn't enough physical evidence, or even without going in depth, there wasn't enough evidence to link them. And so what we didn't want to do was put a case on him and then have him beat it, because then it might look like he may be able to beat the rest of them. We wanted nothing but solid cases. And he said, give him 7 years in prison and he'd tell me about the rest of them. Well, that never happened. He changed his mind, didn't like the way I badmouthed him when the state allowed him to get married.
Right.
And I said it was a mockery of the criminal justice system. He's not there for rehabilitation. He's there for the death sentence. Mm-hmm. And it was a mockery of the sacrament of marriage, because his marriage would never be consummated. And why did we have to allow him to do that?
Do you wish he would have had to go through the death penalty? Or is cancer okay with you? What, wasn't it cancer he got?
Yeah, it was cancer, hepatitis. He had... He was a sick puppy.
Yeah.
He had a combination of cancer and hepatitis and didn't take medicine. And they said in the end, he looked almost green because his body was shutting down on the inside. No, it really didn't bother me one way or another. I remember it was June 7th, 2013. I was at my grandson's junior high school graduation, and my daughter, who was a social butterfly with the media, says, Dad, Richard just died. Richard Ramirez just died. And I said, I don't care. I'm here for my grandson right now. And I didn't pay any attention to her. When I got out and I checked my phone, I now had at least 40 messages on there from friends, media outlets. And by the time I got home, I had Channel 7, Channel 5, Channel 4, Channel 2. they were all at my house and gave statements, you know, he was dead. And it was really, I knew, hey, no more appeals. You know, his appeals were over with. And he asked me and Frank both, Frank and myself, he said, are you going to come to the day they execute me? And Frank said, you're damn right I am. And he said, what about you, Gil? I said, Frank, you know, honestly, I don't really care. I said, you want me there? I'll go. But if you're not, I've seen enough death and destruction from combat, from people on the streets and patrol, and all the murder I've seen here. I said, I've seen enough people die. But if you want me there, I'll be there. If not, no, I ain't going. And he said he wanted me there. I said, okay, you want me there, I'll be there. Got my word.
Do you think, and obviously I don't mean this in the literal term, but was there like an understanding of some sort of bond? I wouldn't go so far as to call it friendship, but I think after everything was done and he was in there and he was confessing some of these things, was there at least some sort of bond, even if it's a cop and criminal bond that you two had?
Yeah, there's no doubt. Plus, he knew I did some good. He got word to me. He let me know that his mother and sister were taking a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. Back in El Paso. Right. So I had friends in the police department back there. So I said, hey, do me a favor, do some drive-by, let them see you, you know, take the heat off them. They didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And so he knew that I had done something good for him. And I, when I met his mom and sister, when they came out here, I introduced myself and I said, I know you have a lot of questions. I also know that that's your son and you love him and your brother and you love him very much. I said, I will never ask you a question about Richard. Never. If you want to know something about what I did or what's going on, feel free to ask me. But I suggest you tell his attorney first. But I won't ask anything because I know you love him.
Yeah. Well, Gil, first off, I want to say thank you for your service. Second of all, I want to say thank you for this interview. It's been fantastic. You have a heck of a career, man. And, you know, I know you dabbled a little bit with George Lopez doing the podcast thing. You do have the movie coming out. You're looking good, man. You're staying busy. I don't know what you got next coming down the pipe, but you know, we wish you the best of luck in any future endeavors, man. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you. It took 40 years to get out there. I don't know when the next time I'll be back, but if I do, I'll hit you up. Maybe we can have a shot at that Jose you were talking about.
There you go. Hit me up. I'm here.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am Hollywood Wade. That was Gil Carrillo. And unfortunately we are out of time. Tune in next week for an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment. Gil, we appreciate you, my friend.
You bet. Peace out. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Oh boy, what an episode that was. I hope everyone is enjoying it. If you are enjoying it, head on over to YouTube, like, subscribe, hit that notification bell. That way you get notified every time we drop a video. And of course, on all the audios, do whatever you can to help us out, folks. Like, share, 5 stars, purple hearts, leave us a comment, a review. All that helps put us in the algorithm, drives us up the charts, helps more people learn about the show. That's what you can do. We've never asked you for a dime here on Crime and Entertainment. We just ask that you share the show. Do it on the social medias. Go and like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and of course, follow us on the old TikTok while it's still here. Who knows what the hell the government's going to do about that. We're on all your social media platforms. We put shorts up there daily for you guys to check out. Been a little slagging on the shorts. I got to get back in the groove. Only working on one computer here. So I think I'm going to buy another computer. That way I can be doing shorts on one while I upload stuff on the other. It's a hard gig with a one-man operation. But I definitely appreciate all you guys listening each and every week. I hope you enjoy it. That will do it for today's episode with Gil Carrillo. I'm Hollywood Wade. We'll see you next week on Crime and Entertainment.